Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 17th, 2005. This session is Beyond Words, Sojourners in the Wilderness, Part 5, Whispering Sweet Nothings, presented by Fred Niedner. In the Fireside Room, Disc Number NIF 2005-05.
Now that we know what it means. Good morning. My name is Fred Niedner from Valparaiso, Indiana. I have been introducing myself most of the week as a person who this week serves the village as ogre. And I've explained each day that it has a variety of meanings. I take it as an acronym, old guy reading Exodus. And this is the last of the series in which I can really do that, because today ends the series that I've entitled Beyond Words, Wilderness Sojourns and Sojourners. Beyond Words is the way I understand the meaning of the word wilderness in the Hebrew language in which the Bible is written. It's a combination of the Hebrew word for word and a preposition that indicates separation. And so I think of the wilderness as the place beyond words, the place where our language and our systems of meaning either no longer apply, or they have failed us, or there simply aren't any for us out there. And so it's a way to describe, among other things, transitions, like the way from freedom, the way from freedom to slavery is a wilderness as well, as they found out in that Israel when they went into exile. But the way from bondage to freedom is the long wilderness story from which we take our theme text this year in Exodus 3. And so we've started each session some way or another with Exodus and Exodus 3 in particular, and moved out from there. I've also begun each day, for the sake of Holden tradition, with alleged hilarity. And I've brought along something slightly different today. I know this is just slightly risky, but there's a lot of conversation in the village right now, as there is all through the church, in fact, about worship and the styles and languages and kinds of things that you use and do together in worship. And someone sent me this story recently that I don't think has been widely distributed all over the internet, so maybe a few of you haven't heard it. It's about the Worship Wars discussion of hymns. And so here's how this story goes. An old farmer went to the city one weekend and attended a big city church, and he came home and his wife asked him how it was. And well, said the farmer, it was good. They did something different, however. They sang praise choruses instead of hymns. Praise choruses? Said his wife. What are those? Oh, they're okay, said the farmer. They're sort of like hymns, only different. Well, what's the difference? Asked his wife. The farmer said, well, it's like this. If I were to say to you, Martha, the cows are in the corn, well, that would be a hymn. If, on the other hand, I were to say to you, Martha, 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 oh, Martha, 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 the cows, the big cows, the brown cows, the black cows, the white cows, the black and white cows, the cows, cows, cows are in the corn, or in the corner, in the corner, in the corn, 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 corn. And then if I sang that whole thing two or three times, that would be a praise chorus. As luck would have it, the exact same Sunday, a young new Christian from the city church attended the small town church. He came home and his wife asked him how it was. Well, said the young man, it was good. They did something different, however. They sang hymns instead of regular songs. Hymns, said his wife, what are those? The young man said, well, it's like this. If I were to say to you, Martha, the cows are in the corn, well, that would be a regular song. If, on the other hand, I were to say to you, O Martha, dear Martha, hear thou my cry. Inclinest thine ear to the words of my mouth. Turn thou thy whole wondrous ear by and by to the righteous, inimitable, glorious truth. For the way of the animals, who can explain? There in their heads is no shadow of sense. Hearkenest they in God's Son of his reign, unless from the mild tempting corn they are fenced. Yea, those cows in glad bovine rebellious delight have free in their shackles their warm pens eschewed. Then goaded by minion of darkness and night, they all my mild Chilliwack sweet corn have chewed. So look to that bright shining day by and by, where all foul corruptions of earth are reborn, where no vicious animal makes my soul cry, and I no longer see those foul cows in the corn. Then, if I were to do only verses 1, 3, and 4 and do a key change on the last verse, that would be a hymn. Okay. Well, this is a new signal. Is something you're not quite on?
Is there a way to turn these lights on?
Maybe.
Thank you very much.
That's part of it. All right. We saw some pretty rough characterization of the wilderness people and the wilderness period yesterday in what we did, looking at all the murmuring and we're not going to do it, but I thought afterwards we should have all done in unison those great Hebrew and Greek verbs. And we sat here together and in unison said, go get down, go get down, go get down. Psalm 78 joins the number of texts that says that the wilderness was just one long moaning and complaining and whining and a contentious period. When Nehemiah tells the story of gathering the people of Israel to listen to Moses' holy charge to them, it contains the story of the wilderness as nothing but one long rebellion. The book of Ezekiel says pretty much the same thing as well. But as I said yesterday, there are a few texts in which the wilderness is quite the opposite. Jeremiah 2 is an example of a text like that. It's brief. I'll just read you a couple of verses from the beginning of Jeremiah 2. Thus says the Lord, I remember the devotion of your youth, your love as a bride, how you followed me in the wilderness in a land not sown. Israel was holy to the Lord, the first fruits of his harvest, and all who ate of it were held guilty. Disaster came upon them, says the Lord. No hint of unfaithfulness, no hint of disaster coming upon also the bride. So there's this idealized picture of the wilderness that we see in Jeremiah, and it's at a couple of other spots in Jeremiah. Jeremiah is heavily influenced by the prophet Hosea. And it was the prophet Hosea who, as far as I can tell, first wrote about the wilderness as a positive, even an ideal time for the Israelites. And so we're going to spend a little bit of time this morning in Hosea. Amos, a contemporary of Hosea, says something that indicates he may have had a similar view in Amos 5:25 in a tirade about current worship practices. Amos simply asks, did you bring me sacrifices and offerings the 40 years in the wilderness, O house of Israel? Seeming to indicate that that was an uncomplicated time, but no mention of rebellions or not. But Hosea, in chapter 9, for example, verse 10, has the Lord speaking, or God speaking like this. Like grapes in the wilderness, I found Israel, like the first fruit on the fig tree in its first season. I saw your ancestors, but they came to Baal Peor and consecrated themselves to a thing of shame and became detestable like the thing they loved. So there's no hint of trouble in that story till the people come into the land and start getting involved with the Baal religion in Canaan. But the wilderness is the time of our first love. That's Hosea's view of wilderness. The most developed texts in the book of Hosea are at the beginning and then in chapter 11, and we're going to look briefly at those together. Hosea begins with something a little different than a typical call story of the kind that some of us looked at together on Monday. Hosea simply speaks of how when the Lord, or the narrator, tells the story of how when the Lord first spoke through Hosea, Hosea was told to go take for yourself a wife of, NRSV says, whoredom, harlotry, and have children of harlotry, for the land commits great harlotry by forsaking the Lord. So the Lord went and took Gomer, daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. And of course, the names of the children are the names of what you can expect this people to have as an identity so long as they are unfaithful to God in the way that Gomer is unfaithful to Hosea, or at least has been. And I don't mean to spend a lot of time with that. If you, some of you are very familiar with this anyway, he names the first child Jezreel, which is a play upon a historical moment in the history of the dynasty that's in power at the time. That was the place where they took power, and it's a word that means God sows, as in sows seed, and only now it will come to mean something very negative. God will sow destruction for this dynasty and for its people. The next child that's born is a daughter, and he's told to name that child Lo Ruhama, which sounds so pretty if you just listen to the syllables. Literally, it means not having compassion or not cared for. Unloved is what some translations say. But the way this functions in Hebrew, I translate it slightly differently so that you can get the effect. I translate it, no one cares. So that you have to imagine this child going around being asked her name. And when she goes to school and the teacher says, "What is your name, child?" she says, "No one cares." And later on, when she has other roles in society and she's a parent, for example, and someone asks, "Who is your mother?" they say, "No one cares," etc. And on her tombstone, it'll say, "Nobody cares who's buried here." The next child, another son, is named Lo Ami, and Am is the Hebrew word for real people, as opposed to Goy, which is everybody else. And so to be named not a real person is really to be named nobody. So he has to go around with that idea. And on his tombstone, it'll say, "Nobody was buried here." And of course, the point is that this is what Israel gets when they do not keep faithfulness with Yahweh, because in the prophetic point of view, which the covenant as they saw it and the history as they read it with that business in Genesis 12, 1-3, the identity of Israel as God's last hope for this world that's currently dominated by one curse after another, and we're going to try blessing instead of curse, and if that doesn't work, there is always the Noah option one more time. And to give up on the whole thing, which God almost does at that point. And so if this little thing doesn't work, it's over. And so from then on, in the prophetic point of view, God and Israel are stuck with each other. If God gives up Israel, God gives up, first of all, God's own reputation, as we saw yesterday, but God gives up the whole business of the dream of a world and not being alone. If Israel gives up on God, Israel is literally nobody and nothing. And so these partners in the covenant, the way the prophets saw it, could not give up on each other. And Israel was becoming nobody. But we'll see the other half of the problem in the next chapter. In chapter 2 of Hosea, we have a legal document. Chapter 2, verse 2 begins, at least in my English Bible, with the sentence, "Plead with your mother, plead, for she is not my wife." And the word, therefore, plead in the Hebrew happens to be the very same word from which we named that one place of bad water yesterday, Meribah. Reeb is the word you use when you announce that you are filing a lawsuit. Remember I told you yesterday they threatened Moses with suing over the water? Well, when you wrote out a bill of divorce, which a man at this point in Israel's history could do for practically any reason, it's not totally relevant here because this is different kinds of marriage partners. But if you wanted to write out a bill of divorce and end the marital relationship, you simply wrote out a man, did it by writing out a document that said, I lodge this suit, this woman is no longer my wife, and here are the 1, 2, or 3 reasons, and that's that. You hand this woman a bill of divorce, and it no longer is a member of the household or under the care of this family. women could do it for very, very, very few reasons. Insist that they be allowed a divorce. The Mishnah and the Talmud describe some of them that were already very ancient. For example, if you were married to a tanner and you found that you simply could not live with the odor because a tanner always smelled like the acids that were used for tanning hides. It was impossible to get off of your skin. And if a woman simply could not live with that, she was allowed to ask for a divorce. So there were a few reasons. But anyway, here is Yahweh writing out a bill of divorce in the typical form for this era to get rid of this unfaithful wife. And the children are called as witnesses that I am not her husband, that she put away her whoring from her face, her adultery from between her breasts, or I will strip her naked and expose her, as in the day she was born, and make her like a wilderness, and turn her into a parched land, and kill her with thirst. Upon her children I will have no pity, and here's that Lo Ruhamah name again. By the way, if you, as you know from the controversial, because it's not actually in some of the manuscripts, text of John 8 about the woman taken in adultery, about whom Jesus says, "Let those without sin cast the first stone." That practice comes from the Torah. A woman caught in adultery was to be taken outside the city gates and stoned to death. And that's what the husband threatens here in this lawsuit. This is what I really ought to do. I'm going to just divorce her, but what I really ought to do is take her outside the gates and have her stoned. Well, the way this document works is that at verse 6 and verse 9, you have the clauses, what in English appear to be therefore clauses, which state the course of action that this suing husband will take against this unfaithful bride. I will take back my grain, my wine, my wool, my flax, and so forth. I will hedge her up with thorns and try to keep her in, etc., etc. But suddenly at verse 14, the therefore clauses, just when you expect the final one that says, I'm out of here and so is she, look what God says in Hosea's oracle. Therefore, I will now allure her. It's the Hebrew word for seduce in several other texts. I will bring her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. From there I will give her her vineyards and make the valley of Achor a place where a terrible thing had happened, a door of hope. And there she shall respond as in the days of her youth, as at the time when she came out of the land of Egypt. So again, a picture of the idealized wilderness. What we saw yesterday was the very first thing that happened after the crossing of the sea was complaining and wrangling and lawsuits. But that's not how Hosea remembers the story. It's back for a honeymoon in the wilderness, my dear. That will work. On that day, says the Lord, you will call me my husband. You won't roll over in your sleep anymore and call me Baal. That used to really bug me. I will remove the names of the Baals from her mouth, and so on. And then it involves restoration of the whole creation and renaming of the children, and so forth. So this is an alternative view of the wilderness, the place of restoration, the place to go back to. I suppose we could say the place of retreat, a place you go to on purpose to restore, to try to restore what you used to have by getting away from all the things that have corrupted what we used to have together. So that's Hosea's view of the wilderness. But it's also a view of the God who cannot give up this people regardless of their unfaithfulness. It's not just Israel who is lost without God. God would lose terribly without this people. Now, just because we're in Hosea, and I love it, we're going to do Hosea 11, which is its own kind of wilderness piece, and it's another piece of this business of God simply being unable and unwilling to let go. At least that's how I read Hosea 11. It's got a glimpse of the wilderness. Again, this piece is written in relationship to some legal proceedings that you do in Israel. The chapter 2 is a bill of divorce. Chapter 11 is an account of what you do according to the Torah when you have a rebellious child whom you cannot discipline. Deuteronomy 21, verses 18 and following says that if you have a rebellious child whom you have tried to discipline and failed, you take this child to the city gates and you explain there to the elders all your attempts to work with this child and the history of the child's rebellion. The elders will listen to you, and if they agree that this child is indeed incorrigible, then they and you together will stone this child to death, and you will thus bring fear to all Israel, but your eye shall have no pity. So, that would solve all the problems of our society, right? Rebellious young people? Kill them. And a death penalty What we don't know is whether they did this. Whether this was just on the books for the purpose of scaring children. So instead of like my father did when we were little children and we wouldn't eat, he went and put his hand on the button on the telephone and pretended to call the garbage man and said, "I've got a couple of kids here who won't eat. You better come pick them up." In the old days, you just said, "Look, kid, we're going to do Deuteronomy 21 here in a minute." As opposed to Matthew 18. Never mind. it's a story of exasperated parent. Hosea 11 is the story of an exasperated parent doing what's prescribed in Deuteronomy 21. It's the parent at the city gates speaking to the elders. "When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. But the more I called, the more they ran away, sacrificing to the Baals, offering incense to idols. I taught Ephraim to walk," another name for the northern kingdom. "I took him in my arms. They didn't know I healed them. I led them with cords of human kindness, with bands of love. I was the one who lifted their cheeks to my cheeks. I bent down," and the verb there is actually to nurse them. Just so you know which parent it is. "So I guess they'll return to the land of Egypt. Assyria shall be their king because they've refused to return to me. My people are bent on turning away. To the Most High they call, but he does not raise them up at all." All right, this is the moment when you would start the stoning, if the elders agreed with you. But now the parent changes tone, just as does the husband in Hosea 2. "How could I give you up, Ephraim? How could I hand you over for this stoning, O Israel, and make you like Admah or Zeboim?" Those are two cities mentioned in a couple of spots as neighboring villages to Sodom and Gomorrah, who got collateral damage when God nuked those two larger places in the famous story. "My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender." The word for recoil there, "my heart recoils within me," is the very verb that's used in Genesis 19 for what God did to Sodom and Gomorrah. So the very thought of punishing, doing away, getting rid of this child does to God's heart what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah. "My compassion grows warm and tender." There's a couple words in Hebrew for compassion. The one that's here there's a textual problem. We don't know if it's the one that means to breathe in rhythmic painting or if it's the one that means womb. Perhaps you've heard that the Hebrew word for compassion is the word for a plural of the word for womb, so that to have compassion on someone is to treat them as though they were once in your womb. And moms have been known to look differently on their kids than others might when it seemed appropriate to whack someone. I will not execute my fierce anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim, for I am God, not a mortal. I am the Holy One. And God has this unique reputation to uphold. God is different. God is not just a mortal. God is not just a vengeance seeker. God is not just a punisher. So I won't come in wrath. Well, this is the parent who won't go through with the stoning that's actually called for at the city gates on the rebellious child. Now, there's a lot of debate about this among the scholars, and this is fraught with textual problems as well, and we can't go into all of that, but here's one of the problems. This is at least how I read Hosea's oracle, but we all know that it wasn't too long after this that the northern kingdom came down, because the Assyrians destroyed it. And the rest of the prophetic tradition, especially the southerners, said this was God's judgment on those people for their unfaithfulness. But Hosea promises, and we kept it in the canon, saying, God said no to that. God says, I will not go through with that. And yet we know that the stones flew. And so the way I see this, when God says, I am the Holy One in your midst, I come not in wrath. I picture this mother at the city gates holding the child while the stones fly. So that when Israel goes down under the Assyrians, well, to me, this is theology of the cross. God takes the blow. God cannot give up this people. That part just can't be. So if Israel goes down, God takes the punishment too. That's where that wilderness piece takes us. Whispering of a different kind in the wilderness. Now, I wanted to do something else. Questions about that?
Fred, what would you attribute the difference of the wilderness perspectives to? You talked about, on the one hand, the murmuring, on the other hand, the wilderness is a place of purity. Is that
why are there two such radically different views?
Yeah, so before or after the exile, I suppose. Or
well, I suppose the standard view among scholars is that the picture of it as a time of rebellion is a later picture, and it's a picture that's added in order to develop the notion that Israel has from the get-go been difficult for God, and that God and Israel's whole life together from the wilderness on has been trouble. And there are prophets on both sides. It's not like one view is the prophetic view and the other view is the priestly view or something like that. There are prophets on both sides. So,
because in another way, it really sounds like nostalgia. when there's
Hosea and Jeremiah?
Well, the saying the wilderness was the wonderful honeymoon.
Yeah.
Saying, you know, when the kids were little, it was so magnificent.
Yeah.
Even though when the kids were little, you know, it was just magnificent.
Sort of like all that email that we get about, remember when kids didn't have to, you know, do this, that, and the other thing, and forgetting, of course, what the 50s were really like. That's what happens when old guys read Exodus. I don't want to cut off. There's something else I wanted to do this morning. It's going to be hit and run. If we have about 20 minutes left. There's a piece of tradition in the Bible that is sort of vaguely wilderness oriented because of the way it gets picked up in the prophetic tradition and the New Testament. There really isn't a wilderness story, but I love it and I want to do it, so I'm going to do it. It's about Rachel, and this will be a little piece of something I did here in the village about 10 years ago once. When I first stumbled across some things about Rachel, but there's something very much like this this theology of Hosea's in a theme that runs through the references to the ancient mother Rachel in the Bible. We ran into Rachel earlier in the week when we did betrothal stories. It was Rachel who came to the well. And met Jacob and ultimately became Jacob's wife. And we know that then there was this remarkable event of Jacob finding he's with the wrong woman in the morning. Lots of us over the years have wondered how that could happen. And I have an explanation for it before the morning is out from Rachel herself. How this could happen. But you know the story then that there were two sisters married to the same man, one loved and one not. And both stories are very poignant and remarkably deep theological stories. And Leah's is worth telling sometime too, but this morning we have time only for Rachel. Rachel was the one who didn't bear children for a long time while Jacob kept getting the wife he didn't love pregnant year after year after year. Genesis 29 says, if you want to be looking at some of this, it's Genesis 29:31, which simply notes that when the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. And the implication is that simply because her husband loved her, God kept her from having children and opened the womb of this unloved wife so that while she didn't have love, she would at least have children. And poor Rachel was supposed to live on love, but no children, which of course for an ancient mother didn't work. Genesis 30 verses 1 and 2. When Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, she envied her sister, and she said to Jacob, "Give me children or I'll die." Jacob became very angry with Rachel and said, "Am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb?" This is how they saw the workings or not workings of childbearing. But eventually, near the end of that chapter in verse 22 and following, we read that God remembered Rachel. So it was God after all, according to the narrator anyway, who was in charge of all this fruitfulness or unfruitfulness. God remembered Rachel and heeded her and opened her womb. She conceived and bore a son and said, "God has taken away my reproach," and she named him Yosef, which is Hebrew for "May it happen again." Saying, "May the Lord add to me another son." So that everybody who came and saw her new baby and asked the baby's name, and she said Yosef, and they said, Yosef. How nice. They joined her prayer to have another one. Which she eventually did, but not right away. In Genesis 35, verses 16 and following, we pick up the next bit of Rachel's scant story.
So Genesis.
Then they journeyed from Bethel. They're on the road when this happens, the whole family. And when they were still some distance from Ephrath, which is near Bethlehem, Rachel was in childbirth and she had hard labor. When she was in her hard labor, the midwife said to her, "Do not be afraid, for now you will have another son," which is what she prayed for. As her soul was departing, before she died, she named him Ben-Oni, which means son of my sorrow, for she would never miss or see this child grow. But his father called him Ben-Yamin, son of the right hand, son of favor, son of good fortune. So Rachel died, and she was buried on the way to Ephrath, which is Bethlehem. And Jacob set up a pillar at her grave. It is the pillar of Rachel's tomb, which is there to this day, which is still true, by the way. It's still there, and I'm sure at least one of you has seen it. It's got a new big wall around it so that Palestinians can't get close. And there's a lot of fighting there and many children killed, but it's still there. Israel journeyed on and pitched his tent beyond the tower of Adair. So that's Rachel's sad story. Because her husband loved her more than her sister, through no fault of her own, God closed her womb. She cries out to her husband, not to God, that she must have children or she will die. And of course, as we've seen, the answer to her prayer kills her. Now here's the little tiny bit of wilderness that's here, the land beyond words. With her dying breath, she names her child for her sorrow. But her husband, surely thinking to do a kindness to this child, who would want to go around with the name son of my sorrow? As a kindness to this child, he renames this child son of favor, but in doing so, he silences Rachel. Her voice is stilled. Her tears cut off with the change of name. And so she goes into, at this point, the land beyond words. She has no more words, nor will she for 1,000 years. There is no more mention of Rachel from this point for 1,000 years until the prophet Jeremiah. As he watched in the aftermath of the Babylonian onslaught against the people of Israel, right near Ephrath, the point at which the Babylonians organized the marches of naked exiles off to Babylon. The word for going into exile in Hebrew is galah, which means to walk naked, to go naked. Because the Assyrians who preceded the Babylonians had taught military tacticians how to take people into exile most effectively. You strip them naked and force march them because they were much more docile that way than if you let them keep their clothing and their belongings. And so Jeremiah watched as the Babylonians got the groups together to march them off into exile. And as he watched this scene in Jeremiah 31, 15, and following, he recalls this. "Thus says the Lord, a voice is heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel is weeping for her children. She refuses to be comforted for her children because they are no more. So Rachel gets called from her tomb there at Ephrath to weep for these her seed. The people whom she died to give birth to now are marching past on the way into oblivion. And she weeps, refusing all consolation. But of course, that's not where Jeremiah's oracle ends. Immediately, this follows. Thus says the Lord, keep your voice from weeping and your eyes from tears, for there is a reward for your work, says the Lord. They shall come back from the land of the enemy. There is hope for your future, says the Lord. Your children shall come back to their own country. That verse, first Rachel's refusal of consolation, but God's quick promise then to restore the children and bring them back, has gotten enormous attention in the history of Jews and Christians. I want to give you a little bit of the history of that that interest. There's a wonderful book that has a lot of this in it by Samuel Dresner called Rachel, and there might even be a copy or two over in the bookstore. I'm pretty sure there's one in the library. among other things, we know as Christians that we can't tell the story of the birth of Jesus without this verse. Matthew used this verse and brought again Rachel's tears for our story. To this day, Jews on as part of the High Holy Days in Rosh Hashanah use this reading from Jeremiah 31 for the second days, the second of the High Holy Days. This is the primary text. Why can't we tell the story without these tears, without Rachel's reaction, either of our Messiah, or why must the Jews remember this? Well, the rabbis give us a good clue. Lots of Midrash tradition started about this this little text, and a Midrash is a story that tries to respond to a mystery or something missing, or a question that another text or story raises. And the question the rabbis asked is, what is the connection between Rachel's refusal of consolation and God's quick promise of restoration that appears to happen in Jeremiah 31? And here are a couple of midrashim that the Jewish rabbis taught. We don't know the ages of these things. We're relatively sure that some of them are pre-Christian. But one of the stories, to explain this, says that God was looking for somebody to come and weep over the destroyed city of Jerusalem with God. And God had called several of the ancient worthies to come and do this. Abram, for example, God had called, said, Abram, come weep with me over the loss of the city. The city is destroyed. Jerusalem is in ruins. And Abram said, I should come and weep with you? When my hand was poised with the knife over my son, you stopped that and saved the future of my family. Why couldn't you stop this? In fact, you could have, so I will not come weep with you. God calls Moses, and Moses says, I will not come weep with you. When I led the people to the Red Sea and the Pharaoh pursued us and could have killed us all, you got us through. You could have stopped this, so slaughter too, and didn't. So weep yourself. God was used to this, of course, from Moses. This is how they did with each other. And so eventually in this midrash, God calls Rachel. And there are two versions. There are two different midrash at this point. In the one of them, that explains what happened on the wedding night many centuries before, Rachel comes to God and says, "Well, God, I will weep with you, but I do have to tell you this. You remember my wedding night? How my sister was given to my beloved on the night of our wedding? Would you like to know how it was that Jacob never figured out who it was he was in bed with?" "When I realized what was going on," Rachel said, "I knew that Jacob would be furious and that he would harm my sister if he knew who he was with. And so I hid under the bed, and every time he spoke, I answered so that he would not know. And it broke my heart. And if I could do that for my sister, who was making love to my husband, you could save this people despite their unfaithfulness." Mm-hmm. And according in that midrash, God says, "You're right. I will do it. I will return your children to their parents." In the other midrash, that's the twin to that, Rachel simply comes and makes no complaint to God like Abram or Moses had done. She simply weeps inconsolably. She refuses all consolation. And finally God says, "I will do it." Luther wrote about this text and why it has to appear in the Christmas story, connected, of course, to the slaughter of the innocents at Bethlehem. And Luther says that, and this is all spelled out in great detail along with a whole lot more theologizing that we don't have time for this morning in a wonderful systematic theology text by a man named Christopher Morse, who teaches at Union Seminary in New York, and he's written a book called Not Every Spirit, and he starts out with a method of doing theology that's titled Rachel's Refusal. And the method of theology in this book is simply you refuse any and all consolation save that costs God everything of the kind that comes on the cross. Any other consolation is cheap. That is the only consolation that counts. Luther said something like that there are some things that happen among us human beings, and more than we really know, that can only be responded to by God, and that cost God everything to respond to. And Luther, that was a part of Luther's preaching on one Christmas, and grows out of his theology of the cross. There's another midrash that goes with all this that is in the mystical texts of Judaism, the Zohar, and this one happens to be in the description of when the Messianic Age will be inaugurated. And in this mystical Zohar text, the Messiah comes and does all the... Actually, there's a lot of battle that happens in this text, and the Messianic Kingdom is not established necessarily by nonviolence. But ultimately, the Messiah succeeds in controlling the world, and then waits 30 days in the calm for the coronation and the beginning of the Messianic Age. And in the 30 days, the major question is, where shall the coronation happen? At what point on the face of the earth should the Messiah be crowned and the Messianic Age begin? And in the Zohar, the place, of course, is Ephrath, on the road to Bethlehem, where Mother Rachel weeps yet. And only this can stop her tears. And in the moment of his coronation, Rachel will rise up and kiss him. So if that text is older than Matthew, Matthew couldn't tell the story of the Messiah's coming without Rachel. You simply couldn't do it. Now, we have 1 minute or so. One of the most remarkable uses of this Rachel stuff, and this, we're now no longer in Bible, we're in something else, literature class or something. Some of you know that Moby Dick plays with this. Melville in Moby Dick names one of the whaling ships in his story, the Rachel. And you know, there's a perfect reason for it. This book, drenched in biblical symbolism, Melville gives the name Rachel to this whaling ship when her captain boards the Pequod and pleads for help in searching for his lost sailors. Among them, his own son, and is then ordered off the ship by Ahab. The whalers from the Rachel part, and they proceed on their separate ways, and the Rachel is lurching and heaving on the heavy seas. And Melville writes at that point, by her still halting course and winding woeful way, you plainly saw that this ship that so wept with spray still remained without comfort. She was Rachel weeping for her children because they were not. And then, of course, the end. Having recounted the sinking of Ahab's ship in the final chapter, the epilogue concludes by describing how Ishmael, the sole survivor and the teller of the tale, is miraculously saved. I'm just going to read this last paragraph, if I can. So, floating on the margin of the ensuing scene and in full sight of it, that is, of the sinking, when the half-spent suction of the sunk ship reached me, I was then but slowly drawn towards the closing vortex till the coffin life buoy shot lengthwise from the sea, fell over and floated by my side. Buoyed up by that coffin for almost one whole day and night, I floated on a soft and dirge-like mane. The unharming sharks, they glided by as if with padlocks on their mouths. The savage seahawks sailed with sheathed beaks. On the second day, a sail drew near, then nearer, and picked me up at last. It was the devious cruising Rachel that in her retracing search after her missing children, only found another orphan. And I love that vision of the church. You know, church as ship, church as Rachel, cruising the seas looking for her lost children. Out there beyond words. Sorry. And we're out of time. Thank you.
That was beautiful.